This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. If you've been to the Monte, you've heard of Jeff Polish.
Welcome. My name is Jeff Polish, and I'm the director of the Monte, and thank you for coming. We have a packed house tonight, so give yourself a hand. Now, I know what you were thinking when I came up here. You were probably thinking, that Jeff Polish is one sexy son of a bitch. Is that what you were thinking? I saw you look at me, sir. I saw that.
Jeff Polish hosts and directs the Monte, a public storytelling event that moves around the triangle and triad. It's a simple concept. People tell a true story without notes to a room full of strangers. Its success lies in the complicated relationship between storytelling and emotional vulnerability. According to Jeff's calculations, every one of us has at least one great story to tell. So the Monte should be able to go on forever. The idea is gratifying to a guy who grew up in a self-protective silence. How did Jeff's difficult childhood lead him to a life behind the microphone? We're going to find that out today on the program when we meet Jeff Polish. Welcome back, Jeff. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Frank.
You should tell us again the kind of the short version of what is the Monte.
Well, you said it very well. It's basically I invite people, anybody essentially, to tell a story in front of a live audience. It's got to be a true story. And that's all it is. It's very stripped down. It's nothing could be more pure than just a simple, true story told in front of a live audience.
And now it sounds a lot like The Moth in New York City.
The Moth actually gave me the idea to start here, but it's something that I had thought of. Boy, if I could find a forum for my stories, that would be great. And when I saw the success of The Moth, I thought maybe that could work here. And not only can it work here, it thrived here.
It's not The Moth, it is The Monte. The Monte. Why The Monte?
Well, the name The Monte came from my best friend in college, Monte, who, when I met him, all we did was tell each other stories. And our very first conversation lasted, and I'm not even kidding, 10 hours. We were in college, so you could do that. Right. And 10 hours of just simple exchange of stories back and forth. And when we left that conversation, we were best friends. That's what a story can do. It can bring people really close together.
Now, people know that. People have talked about that. And I think anybody who has ever told or heard a story has internalized it. But then there's this concept that you had, and I guess the courage, to actually invite an audience. You got to buy a ticket. You know, will people actually pay to hear somebody else tell a story?
Well, that's a good question. So at our very first show in April of 2008, I enticed people to come by inviting some big names in literature like Clyde Edgerton, Daniel Wallace, Joanna Catherine Scott, a lot of local big names. I didn't realize how many writers there are in this area, but this place is teeming with great literary talent all over the state.
Right.
And so that brought in the audience. And once I had them there, I knew that they would stay because who doesn't like a great personal story? Who doesn't like that?
Yeah, it seems though, again, now you've got two scary things. One, can I really convince people to come and pay to listen to other people's stories, even if they're well-known? And then I've got to talk to these well-known writers and ask them to show up and tell a story.
Yeah, well, that was – I mean, that was the easy part, although it seems like the hard part. When I approached these writers, who I didn't know – I mean, at the time, I was actually a stay-at-home dad. I didn't know many people in the Triangle area or the North Carolina area. And I wrote them an email, and I told them about the concept, and they flipped over it. There was another aspect to the writer response, which I get all the time, which is, don't you know that I'm a writer and we like to sit behind our computer screens? We don't like to perform live. But actually, many of them say yes because it's a challenge and it's, you know, connecting with an audience that they don't often get to see.
And it really isn't writing. What are the rules?
Well, the rules of the Monte is that the stories have to be true. They have to be told without notes. There's a time limit, and the limit is 12 minutes. Doesn't mean that we're going to cut their mic at 12 minutes. It means that we're going to let them know that it's time to wrap things up at 12 minutes. And then finally, each story revolves around a theme for the night. So I pick a theme, I reach out to people, and they tell stories revolving around that theme.
And if you do go long, you hear this. Which is?
That's the sound of a hippo talking, actually. And hippos make such an amazing sound. I mean, it sounds like a bunch of wise guys sitting in a back room of a bar laughing. So it's a friendly sound, and it's become our mascot, actually.
And you actually have a story about how the hippo came to be. I think it's probably a little too long to tell here.
Right.
But there is a story.
There is a
hippo.
Story. It's significant. Yeah,
and you're a little bit loose, but you do. It's the fact is, you may hear that hippo a few times, and then it's time to go.
Well, you know, I've told many stories myself at the Monty, and I've been hippoed every time. So you know, it's not a punishment. It's just something. Wrap it up.
There is something also called the Monty Story Slam. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
That's an offshoot of the Monty. It started about a year after our first Monty signature show. And that's where I basically publicize a theme, sell tickets, and then people show up and drop their names in the hat for a chance to tell a 5-minute story on stage. Now, it's only 5 minutes, and we have 8 storytellers, and it's competitive. So we have judges in the audience that are judging each story after they're told.
Now, that name in a hat is really significant because you do work with the writers on the Monty.
Right.
Or the storyteller. They're not right. All writers, by right. the way, and not always well-known mm-hmm. people in the area. But you do work with them as a kind of a coach, so you have some sense of what's going
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
Actually, tell us a little bit about how that goes, the whole coaching process.
Well, I approach them and say, I'm essentially the editor of all the stories told at the Monty. And even writers have editors. So my job is just to make sure that the story is appropriate and that it's well crafted. And most of the time, I am met with a great receptivity. A lot of people are really interested in my feedback because I definitely know what I'm talking about. I'm a great listener, and I really know if a story's working or not. So I meet with the people first and foremost. And if they have a story that's just, bam, it's perfect, that's really the last time that we actually really deal with one another. Many times, though, I give my feedback, and then we talk before the show. They do a run-through with me. And sometimes I'm actually involved in the construction of the narrative. There are notable stories at the Monty where I really had a hand in shaping it, because when I first heard it, I thought, well, I don't feel the narrative arc. And then I start asking questions, and suddenly a new story is born because of that exchange that we
had. Can you give us an example?
Sure. Okay, so I met with this with a woman named Dorothy Clark, and the theme was nature or nature calls. And she wanted to tell a story about this boarding school that she went to in Vermont. And she talked about, you know, milk and cows and all this stuff. It was a bit of a Quaker school. And I just didn't feel the arc there. And so I said, well, where did you grow up before you went to school? And she said, Thomasville, Georgia. And I said, well, what was that like? It sounds like a small town. She said, it is a small town. In fact, every day that I walked to school, I had to walk through a white neighborhood, and there wasn't a single day that went by that I wasn't called the N-word, although she didn't say the N-word. She said the actual word. And the story, I sat there and I listened to her and I said, well, now we're talking story. Now we've got something. And what happened from that moment on was the construction of a very meaningful story about the power of a single word. And it was very, very effective on stage, and it was one of our best stories.
Was she willing to go along with it when you made this observation, or not at first?
Absolutely. No question. Because I'm very sensitive. I'm very psychologically minded when I'm listening to people, and I'm very open, sympathetic, and people feel that when I sit down with them. I mean, not everybody can do this sort of thing. I'm not engaging in therapy, but I am listening very carefully, and I'm speaking to them very carefully.
You'd have to, because it seems to me that what happened there in the first telling of that story was there was this compressed idea, this story that had a backstory. Mm-hmm. That's the one I'm not going to tell you or that audience, Jeff Polish, but out of that backstory comes this other little nosh of a thing, mm-hmm. which to you rings a little flat. Then you bring out the story I didn't want to tell. Now you've got to convince me it's safe enough to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And not everyone wants to go to that very personal place. But the Monty, at the Monty, it's an interesting forum, because the more open you are with your audience, the more they will embrace you. it's just an amazing thing. But if the audience senses that you're holding something back, they will kind of shy away from you.
So there's a real relationship. They're not just out there telling a story.
It is as much about the audience as it is about the storyteller.
I have to tell you, I did. I think in the first season, I told a story, and it was a lot of fun. And you really do feel that. I mean, I had told the story to other people many, many times. Mm-hmm. The idea that this is now a performance, it really was a kind of performance, although about something that really happened, was a very, very different feeling. And it became a different story for me.
Right. Most people that I contact they have great, you know, very extensive public speaking experience, but this forum intimidates them to no end. And Elizabeth Edwards is one of those people. I mean, her ability to speak in public is, you know, I mean, amazing. But when I contacted her about this, she was extremely intimidated. And I worked with her very closely on this story. And it was, she was taken quite a far distance out of her comfort zone because it's so vulnerable. You're up there with no notes. You're telling something very personal about your life, and you don't know how you're going to be received.
We'll talk more about that, how that gets done, and then we'll get back to the Story Slam where you pick names out of a hat so you don't have time to coach. What's that like for you and for everybody in the audience as we continue our conversation today with the founder of The Monty, Jeff Polish, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jeff Polish, the founder of the public storytelling project called The Monty. And we said that when it began, and it continues today, is The Monty is a storytelling project. You work with the storytellers, get some sense of what's going on. Then there's the Monty Story Slam. Mm-hmm. People come up, sit in the audience. You draw names out of a hat. They come up, tell a story you've never heard before.
Oh, yeah.
What's that like?
It is very unexpected. Because I don't know the stories, I have no idea what the quality of the show is going to be. So not only do I decrease the price of the tickets, but we make it a competitive thing. So this is kind of an interesting dynamic. So they're 5-minute stories. So if the story is not good or it's inappropriate or anything, then it's going to be over in 5 minutes anyway. But the competitive aspect behind the whole thing adds a lot of edge to the night. Like, imagine American Idol. Many times you're watching American Idol and 6 of the 8 songs are pitchy, really bad performances. But the fact that somebody's going to get voted off the next night kind of keeps the audience on the edge. There's just some suspense built in. And that's what's going on at the Story Slams, too. I like the fact that I don't know the stories because anything can happen. And sometimes it does happen. And it serves as a very interesting vehicle for my work as the host of the show because I come on in between every story.
I mean, do you ever sit there and just absolutely cringe through the entire thing? I mean, I guess
the entire show?
A story that you think, oh, this is not appropriate.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And, you know, the audience,
of course.
The audience is not subtle about it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to boo and hiss, but they're not going to pretend anything.
Is there a way in which people's perception and even your perception of what makes a good story changes somehow when it's in competition? Is there a way that you can fake it? Is there a way that you can kind of, you know, like in a song, you just got a great hook and there's nothing else going on for it, but you might be the American Idol?
It happens.
Yeah.
It does happen. I mean, some stories for about 4 minutes, it's kind of hanging out in this mediocre land. And then, bam, it suddenly grabs a hold. The audience erupts and that's when they step off stage. And so the judges are left with this euphoric, like amazing finale of a narrative, and that's what helps them to judge. And you know, the bottom line is that not every winner of every night is indeed the best story of the night, but we're having fun. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a loose night. For me, what I don't get from the Monty, I get from the Story Slam, and vice versa. What I don't get from Story Slams, I get from the Monty. So it's a really perfect complement to one another.
You decide, you have this 10-hour conversation with your friend Monty, a conversation mostly an exchange of stories. When did you decide it would be something that you would want to almost, I mean, you're teaching now to make a living, but this has become a real occupation for you as well. was there a time when you thought you could make a living at it?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, you know, this is something that it's a passion project. And we do have a nonprofit status. We mm-hmm. are 501c3. But I don't give myself a salary, or mm-hmm. my board doesn't allow me to get a salary. And it's really just there because it's about community. And it's exciting for me. It gives me so much as an individual that I didn't have before. It's changed my life 100%.
Did you ever want to be a professional storyteller?
I did, actually. In fact, when I was in college, I was a bio major. I wanted to go to medical school. And I saw Spalding Gray, who amazing monologuist. I went to see him and it changed everything. Here's a guy who is telling stories about his life, and I mean, they're filled with neuroses and all sorts of issues, and you know, those made for great stories. And I thought, you know, I have stories too, and I would love to do this. And I considered actually quitting my, you know, bio major, quitting pre-med and going the fine arts route and perhaps moving to New York and writing one-man shows and performing them off Broadway and, you know, making something of myself. But the problem was that I just didn't have the guts. I mean, I didn't know what that life would look like. I knew what being a pre-med or a bio major would look like, but my mother would never have approved either. And, you know, that would have been a hard sell. And I wasn't strong enough to stand up to that.
Your mother's approval plays an important part in what you're doing now.
Absolutely, definitely. So I growing up, and my mother is a pretty domineering woman. She divorced my father when I was about 4 or 5, and I had no concept of what was going on around me. And it was kind of interesting how I was dealing with the reality that was going on in every part of my life, is to take it in and then replay it. As if I were telling myself a story, I would replay it and I would tell myself those stories just so I could understand it. So then as I'm growing up, telling myself these stories, my mother is very, you know, overbearing, very critical of me. And I started to retreat into my own imagination, essentially into my own world. I figured that if I didn't say anything, I wouldn't get in trouble. She wouldn't criticize what I was saying. And so I became very shy and very insecure. But I lived in this place that was amazing. I was a dreamer, a daydreamer, and I was always doing it. And sometimes I would replay stories about myself, but I would change it a little bit. I would emerge as the hero. Nevertheless, these stories were holding up, like they were real stories to me and they were important to me. And then when I went off to college, I realized that I didn't want to stay quiet anymore. I had a voice and I wanted to use it. And so I started to say things. I started to talk, and I realized that the closest or the best way for me to get people's attention was to tell stories. That's what got people interested in me. That's what brought them closer to me.
But what you said too is that it's the vulnerability. It's your vulnerability as a storyteller that mm-hmm. people detect, and that's where the harbor is. That's where people connect and stay with you. And yet you kind of constructed a reality. It was something to keep you alive, keep your mind and emotions intact during a difficult childhood. But it's a constructed reality. So how do you become vulnerable and honest with stories that were a little massaged and not quite the reality?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. So while I was massaging them as a child, I was doing it for my survival, essentially. I needed to know that I was relevant. But when I went off and started to tell these stories to people, I didn't quite massage. I realized that, and it's much more apparent, I'm much more aware of it now, but I realized subconsciously that when you become vulnerable in your stories, when you tell people something where you're not always strong and you're sometimes very scared and insecure, no matter who you're talking to, they can relate to it because everybody is scared. Everybody's scared about something. And once they feel that vulnerability in you, it brings them closer to you. So once I started to realize that that was an in, I was all about that, and I'm still all about that. I'm about that on stage. I'm about that one-on-one. But, yeah, I don't massage like I used to. That was a survival technique, definitely.
Is it fair to call the Monty part of your therapy?
It is absolutely a part of my therapy, and I'm working on things all the time. it's really important, but it's not just for me. It's for other people, and I think people have a true need to tell their stories that are deeply personal and have them be received in a safe place. And that's what the Monty is. I mean, we have all sorts of stories. We have the hilarious bang your fist on the table type story. And then we have the deeply personal, the painful narrative. Mm. And when people tell those, I mean, it's really important for them to feel safe. And they do feel safe in that setting. And when I see that happen, I often think, I can't believe that I'm the guy that created this, which something that is so important to so many people. And I'm the guy. I just did because I love stories. And here we are.
Was there a single moment, was there a moment or one story in the process of the Monty that this all came home?
Absolutely. It was our second show. You were actually telling a story at this show. Tanya Olson gets up there and tells a story about coming out as a lesbian in Ireland, okay, we're discovering that she was a lesbian in Ireland. And there was a moment at the end of the story where she comes home and has to essentially face her mother, who did not approve. And when that happened, I felt like, here's a really important moment, and this is going to work.
It was a remarkable story, and I thought an expert kind of storytelling. And in fact, we have part of Tanya Olson's story from the Monty here. Let's listen.
Not too long before she died, she sent me a letter, and in it she said, "I cry every night because of what you told me, and I can't tell anyone why I'm crying. The only people who know are the women who are in my Bible study group, and they pray for you every day." And as close as I was to my mother, as much as I loved her, I think that was probably the cruelest thing that she ever said to me. But I never really blamed her for not being able to hear that story from me, because there were so many stories of hers that I couldn't hear, you know? I never asked her what it was like to grow up with a single parent in a time when that was not at all the convention. I never asked her what it was like to be a member of a family that was so close that every step you took away from it, you felt like you were losing part of yourself. And I bet those are stories that she would have liked to have told me and that she would have liked me to have heard, but I just wasn't ready to hear them. But I learned from that experience that if you are going to choose not to hear a story that someone wants to tell you, that is a very big responsibility. That is a very big power. That is a very big sword that you need to wield very, very carefully.
It's Tanya Olson telling her story at the first season of The Monty, and I was privileged to be there. And the thing about this is that was 1 minute and 21 seconds of a longer story, 12-minute story, and it was funny. I mean, we were laughing and rolling on the floor, and then these moments. I don't think there was no more powerful story in the world. And it was about storytelling, it turns out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just perfect. It captured exactly what I'm trying to accomplish here. And when she told that story, I was like, this is it. It's going to be around forever. But, you know, Tanya actually told a story about a year and a half later. It was her second story. And she decided that she wanted to tackle this topic, what it was like coming home from Ireland and dealing with her mother as her mother's health was failing. Now, the result of this story was remarkably different. I mean, it was obvious when Tanya got up on stage that she was uncomfortable with the material and that the scope was way too big and it was way too ambitious. And she had some difficulties in the telling. And while I was sitting there, I couldn't have been more proud of what was happening on stage and in the room, because what I learned very profoundly and very deeply in that moment is that if you get up on our stage and you give yourself to the audience and you tell us something honest and real and personal and vulnerable, then the audience will never, never let you go. They will always, always lift you up. And that's exactly what happened to Tanya that night. It was as if they were holding her up while she was struggling through that story. And in that moment, I learned something that has come with me to every storytelling meeting I've ever been to with any storyteller I have, and that is, tell your story, be honest, be open, and you will be loved by that audience.
Which is interesting, because it's not what you're saying also is that it's not about technique, that no amount of practicing, timing, or any of those other things, or put the joke here and it's time for something serious here, that's never going to by itself make a good story.
Right, exactly. Those help sometimes. Yeah. I mean, you know, great timing is great. It's what separates the good storytellers from the fantastic storytellers. But it's very obvious when somebody gets up there and wants to take something from the audience, when somebody gets up there and says, I'm going to get a laugh here. I'm going to get something from them. And when that happens, the audience will just shut down. They will shut it down because we are not interested in anything that is less than fully genuine.
But it's also telling that Tanya, who told that wonderful story the first time, had a hard time technically getting out the second one. We all do that. But it suggests that even our own stories require a certain gestation period. Oh, they need time to
absolutely
form.
I mean, a story just can't be told until it's ready to be told. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people come to me with very raw stories, and I sit down with them. It's our first meeting. 5 minutes in, they're crying, and I'm thinking, well, maybe we need a little more time on this one. Maybe we have to find a different route.
You talked about your mother, living with your mother. What was your relationship with your father after he left?
My father has been in and out of my life for the better part of 30 years, actually. It was tough. I mean, my mother's really strong, and when she wanted to get rid of something, she got rid of it, and he was the thing that she wanted to get rid of. And, I mean, very painful for her. You know, I understand her more now than I did then, but you know, he's been in and out, and he's now in. He's actually been to the Monty, and he's very supportive, and, you know, it's nice to have my father, although it's difficult because I see him, but he didn't raise me. So it's kind of interesting to see this guy who's my father, but you know, what is our relationship? What is that? So we're working through that, and I work through it on stage all the time.
Well, I was going to say, does storytelling clarify that for you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such a storytelling gives you room to reflect so thoroughly on one's life. I mean, it just gives you an opportunity to really think about it and explore it. And I'll tell you, I've explored a lot of things on stage that at the time I didn't even know why I was telling a story. But afterwards, it becomes very clear that I was working on this or that.
You've told stories about your mother.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in the audience.
Actually, first time was last month.
And how'd that go?
Well, that's interesting because she was sitting in the audience, and there was a lot of sort of whispering about what's Jeff going to be like with his mom here, because I talk about her all the time. She is a larger-than-life character. I mean, she's hilarious, too. I mean, there's so much about her that's interesting. And so I got up on stage, and I just let her rip. Most of what I was saying was about her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you know, I used a lot of profanity because she does. I was just quoting her. And uh-huh. It was interesting because I was saying something to her, and that was that this is what I do. I'm an adult, and I will not be silenced anymore. And she loved it. I mean, she may not have quite understood that message I was sending her. In fact, after the show, she said to me, I know that the only way you could have said those things about me is if you love me. And that's not necessarily what I was working on.
Uh-huh. Did you affirm that when she said that?
I smiled.
Okay.
But I mean, it's not that I don't love her. I do love her. But the reality of the situation is a lot more complicated than I say this because I love you. There are complex feelings there. And that's what's going on when I tell stories on stage, is that I'm working on my true the truth of it all.
Does it change things for you? I mean, when you do this now almost professionally, when you do it regularly, and you know what it can do for you, does that change the effect that you can't surprise yourself anymore or as much? You see yourself coming as you construct the story.
The mind is a complex place.
It's a tricky devil, isn't it?
And sometimes I'm working on my stories like I always do, and I'm laughing to myself like, this is a good one. I got this one. And then I go and I do it, and I tell my story. And you are right. I do know I'm very, very good because I've been on stage a lot, and I know what I'm doing up there. So I know where the key points are, where the laughs are and all this stuff. But sometimes it's only afterwards that I realized that I was like a little child acting out up there. You know, and that's just not what I saw coming.
Audience keeps you honest.
Oh, they do.
Yeah.
They really do.
Talking to Jeff Polish today, founder and director of the storytelling project The Monty, and our conversation will continue after a short break. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Jeff Polish, founder and director of the Monty Storytelling Project. And Jeff, you were saying earlier that you got going as a geneticist, you were working on your PhD, and then you turned around and you became a school teacher. What caused that change?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, two things are very different. I mean, every now and then you see a scientist become a high school teacher, but more often than not, that can't happen because most people at that level can't quite communicate effectively with, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds. But while I chose to get a PhD in genetics because I really valued the intellectual pursuit. There's nothing more noble in my mind than doing something and seeking knowledge in something that nobody else has ever sought. And for actually a very short amount of time, I knew something about one little thing that nobody else in the world knew about. Nobody really cares.
I was going to say, there's always the danger that nobody cares either, but go ahead.
I'm under no illusion, but not everyone can say that.
Yeah, it's true. Very true.
But the thing is that graduate school was brutal because you don't get a PhD until you've actually really figured out a problem, a significant problem, and you never know when it's going to end. So it always felt to me like I was on some sort of a life raft. It was a fog in the middle of the ocean, foggy ocean. You couldn't see land anywhere. You knew it was there somewhere. You knew we were going to get there sometime. You just didn't know when. But science, academic research is 85% failure and 15% success. And many good scientists see so much value in the failure, and I do too, but I couldn't quite get myself up in the morning and get excited about another experiment failing. It was brutal, and I spent 8.5 years in that program. And about 4 years into it, I realized that the most fun I was having, or I had had in graduate school, was when I was teaching. I was teaching assistantships at the university, and also I would go into high schools and middle schools and work on, you know, science fair with some kids. And I really thought maybe what I really want to do is connect with kids in a meaningful way at the high school level. And so I went into my mentor's office and I said, I want to do this, and I don't think I need a PhD for this. And he said, well, think about it hard. I mean, he would lose some very cheap labor if I left. But he's like, think about it. I think you'd be really good at that. But think. And so I did, and I realized that I didn't want to quit. I mean, quitting's a big deal. And I didn't want to look back 20 years from that moment and say I could have had a PhD. I figured I only had a year or two left. Mm. Turned out to be four. But I stayed with it and then finished it. And there's not a day that goes by that I'm not proud of that accomplishment, even though I didn't continue with research.
So you're now teaching at the Carey Academy now. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of energy that you get from doing the Monty? Do they feed each other, being a classroom teacher and producing the Monty?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I'm teaching, I mean, the goal is to figure out how to connect with kids so that they are receptive to take the material and learn it. And it's something that I'm good at. I'm very good at connecting with these kids. And what I love about it as an individual is that it's instant feedback. It's not like those experiments that you wait several days. It's instant feedback. You put something out there and they give it back in an honest way. And you are trying to reach them. And so you're performing in a way. And I have to tell you that I tell a lot of stories in class, and they are tied into the material, but they are personal stories too. And I love doing that. And you could see the sparks in the kids' eyes when you're telling them something, a story that relates to the material, and then once they're open, you can give them anything.
You and your wife were living in St. Louis mm-hmm. when you made the decision or started to make the decision to make a transition. Then what brought you to North Carolina?
Well, my wife, Allison, grew up in Greensboro, and her parents still live in Greensboro. And so we figured we could move to the Triangle, which is a vibrant community. Her sister lived here. Still lives here. Her cousin lives here. And so we have this great support system. We had one child and we were going to grow our family. And this would have been, you know, was just a great decision. But we decided this after one of the academic school years, and I left my job and she left her job. We moved with no jobs, and it was a great move. I ended up actually not finding a job for a year, and I stayed home with our child. And I never regretted that decision because the support system here, moving closer to Allison's family, was just such a valuable thing.
This is a theme idea for the Monty, but it occurs so much on this program. And this is people who have now live in North Carolina because their wives wanted to come home. It's mostly wives. There are some men who have brought their wives back here, but it's an incredible you can't believe the number of people who are here for that reason. Guys from some other place, and then they say, we're going where? And she's just on her way. She's packed and gone, and you got to follow her if you want to stay with her. And then they get here, and they say, wow, this is a great place. Good choice.
It's exactly what I thought. I loved the place, but I definitely love, you know, my in-laws.
Yeah.
I mean, so I didn't put up much of a fight, but it was what an amazing state we live in. I mean, it's just there's so much happening here.
Full of storytellers, if nothing else.
Absolutely.
You recently received 501c3 status. Mm-hmm. You're now a nonprofit. Why go that route?
Well, I think that there are a couple of answers to that. But the first is that to me, it's a statement to the community that says, you know, we are about community. We are putting on these events, and we want to be – I mean, really, the mission of the Monty is to create community through the simple telling of stories, and that's what we do every night. But given that it's about community and it's about people, I wanted to create a nonprofit, you know, structure. And, we could also apply for grants, arts grants,
You got a board of directors, which, you know, again, increases the accountability.
Absolutely. It's really been such an amazing learning experience for me because I've never run an organization, and now I have help to do it. And it's just been such an enriching experience.
Were there ideas that you had originally as you conceived this idea and nurtured the thought before your first performance that have changed radically, things you've added or taken out of the initial concept?
I think that there have been some changes. But the amazing thing is that a guy who's never planned a single event in his life, never. I didn't plan my wedding and have anything to do with that. I proposed to my wife. That was an event, I guess. But I had some ideas. I didn't really know why I had these ideas, but I had them, and they seemed to work, and I only learned afterwards why they worked. For example, I didn't want auditorium seats at any of our shows, like rows of seats. I wanted tables where people can be facing in different directions while they're all their heads pointed to the stage. They actually can look at each other a little bit, and one person's reaction can feed into another, who can feed into another, et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, you've got this like very interactive audience. I didn't want it to be in a coffee house. I wanted a bar feel to it,
mm-hmm.
some alcohol there. I wanted it to be a nighttime thing. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be for adults.
Now, you've done it in theaters. You've been at the Art Center, for instance. You go to the Cabaret at the Triad Stage in Greensboro. Mm-hmm. Two fabulous theater spaces,
amazing.
Right? I mean, and the Cabaret certainly got everybody looking at each other, and you get a little bit of that at the Art Center. Is there, can this be too big?
Yes. You know, people will say to me all the time, I mean, we sell our shows out sometimes in 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, we need a bigger space. But I always get this comment, you know, you should be at DPAC. And, you know, I've been to DPAC many times, and it's a wonderful theater, but I just think that some of that intimacy would be lost. I mean, what works the best is when the storyteller is no more than 2 feet from the first audience member. I mean, when you told your story, that was in the early days in a back room at Spice Street. There was no stage. There was somebody within spitting distance of you, right? They were so close. And that intimacy, which I didn't know I was creating, was just so electric. It was so palpable in the moment. And like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. I did it and it worked, and we've kept it going. And anytime we've gone to a venue where there's more physical distance, I have actually felt the intimacy decrease. Now, the Art Center is a theater. It's rows of seats, but you have half the audience facing one direction and half the audience facing another direction. And we leave the lights on so they could see each other, and the place is just alive when we do shows there.
Kind of the key to it then. So you just have to do them more often. That's what you have to do if you want. Not bigger audiences.
Do have a job. Needs attention.
You're involved with something called Broadcaster. Tell us about that.
Broadcaster is interesting. It's a brand new website/mobile app that is a location-based way to put down stories. You could look at a Google map on a website, and there'll be all these digital pins stuck all over the map. If you run your cursor by one of those pins, you could actually play a story that occurred in that exact location. Okay, so it's kind of interesting seeing stories that took place different places. It's a way to connect with different places other than a tour guide book. You know, real people telling real stories. Now, the mobile app is interesting because you on the iPhone, you could set up the geo positioning, whatever you call it. I don't have an iPhone. And you can actually walk around with your iPhone, and as you pass a point where there's a story pinned to, that story will start playing automatically. Now, imagine stories about Ground Zero. You're touring Ground Zero as a tourist. You've got your headphones on. Bam, you hear stories from the first responders to the towers. You hear stories about people fleeing down the stairwells from the towers, and those are up there right now. Same thing with stories about the Holocaust. There are lots of stories pinned to concentration camps. And then you're walking down, and then separately, you're walking down 9th Street in Durham. You got your headphones on, and you hear a great story told live at the Monty. So we have a featured partnership with them, and we have, you know, about 10% of our libraries loaded onto their site.
Is this a kind of a Wikipedia in terms of input? Anybody tell a story? Is there any vetting process for the stories and how they get up there?
I guess there is a vetting process, but anybody can record and upload a story and pin it to a certain place, which is kind of like YouTube, like that.
Yeah.
The reason I say there is a vetting process is that hopefully the listeners will rate the stories, and the highest rated stories will sort of rise to the top of visibility. But there's also a very good search engine. You can search for different stories with different keywords and come up with stories that would not have popped up. But there's going to be a lot of junk on there. But hopefully there are ways for the good stories to sort of rise.
Well, it's fascinating, the possibilities, if you think it through, the idea of public history with a kind of vetting process. Let everybody tell the stories, then let historians go back and they can take a look and do a little fact-checking and then contextualize the story. So you can imagine now how many more voices tell a much more complete history with some kind of editing using this process. And we'd all be the richer for it if we were exploring any particular aspect of our history that we were concerned with.
Absolutely.
Very different, though, than the sort of storytelling you're talking about, because the audience isn't involved. We're not watching the audience react. And the kind of emotional connection that we might have would be different.
Right. I mean, you know, anytime – and we record all of our stories, and we've heard some clips on the show. And it's really nice to hear the audience respond, but there is nothing like being there live that night. I mean, you felt it. It's really something.
So what's the future of the Monty?
Gosh. More
just more. Is it going to be? I mean, it's a wonderful process. You don't have to change a thing. But is it more of that or different ideas? You added the story, Monty Slam. The story
well,
slam.
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily have different formats in mind. Maybe just different markets. And you know, I'm one person, and maybe we franchise it out. I don't know. All I know is that there's a need for this type of expression, and we prove that every night when we sell out all of our shows.
Yeah. Like you said, so, in 4 minutes sometimes. Yeah. I'm late often.
Excuse me?
I'm late.
Yeah, you're late.
So, you know, I know. They sell quick.
Yeah, and so there's a need for it. So yeah. I want to bring it to as many people as possible. And yes, I can record it. Yes, I can make CDs, which we've done. But nothing is like the experience of being there. And so I want to open it up. Maybe bigger venues, not too big, but big enough so that people can see it if they want to.
You've been around now in two different areas. You've been in the Triad and in the Triangle. Is there a difference? Is there a difference in the way people respond to stories? Different kind of story that gets told?
Well, you know, both Greensboro and the Triangle are very vibrant areas filled with, you know, great diversity, great life experience, people from all over the place. And I'm very happy to say that that they're all into it. Mm-hmm. All right, they're all into it no matter what the stories are, what the material is. Like, there's a great reception to it. I can't quite discern if there's a certain type of story that Greensboro likes more than the Triangle.
Do you know if there are stories, there are other adventures like this? We know about the Moth in New York. You've got this going. It seems to me that with the success of both, this would be catching on all over the place and people all over the country would be doing it.
It's popping up. I definitely feel like there are story slam organizations that are popping up in different cities, and the Moth has expanded a bit. It's not easy work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I do it because I'm passionate about it, and I'm passionate about it because I know what stories mean to me, and I have felt what it means to other people. So it's not working for me. It's not work, which is what I mean. It's fun. But I believe that the reason why you just don't see all these organizations popping up is because it's hard.
Well, keep up the good work, Jeff. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Jeff Polish, founder and director of the Monty Storytelling Project. Your next chance to see the Monty, April 7th, the Art Center in Carrboro. Then on April 14th, Triad Stage in Greensboro. That going to be at the stage? Or are you going to be up at Cabaret?
We'll be up in the upstage cabaret.
Up in the Cabaret in Greensboro. That's on April 14th. For more information, go to monty.org. Monty is M-O-N-T-I.
That's the Monty.
It is themonty.org. You know, if you put in Monty, you're going to find it pretty quick. M-O-N-T-I is the spelling. TheMonty.org. The State of Things can be found at stateofthings.org. You can find us on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Robin Copley is our technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. And our senior producer is Susan Davis. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.